Hello everyone and welcome to the Brick Educator Podcast. I'm joined here by Guy. Thank you so much for coming.
Hello Jamie, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
The story really starts in the early 90s. I studied multidiscipline art and design. I very much had a leaning towards three-dimensional art and design, and again a further leaning really towards product design. I chose at the time to specialize in toy design just because I suppose I was a kid and I didn't want to grow up. And when I finished studying, I was at the University of Hertfordshire, or Hatfield Polytechnic as it was then. And when I left, I managed to land some short-term contracts initially with two major toy companies, Mattel and Hasbro, working on boys' toys. So the kind of stuff that you'd know as G.I. Joe, Action Man, some of the branded toys that were specifically aimed at the boy market, as it were. They were both fairly short-term, so six-month contracts. But the toy industry is quite incestuous in the sense that once you work for one, you generally get headhunted or talked to by people that work for others. So yeah. It wasn't until 1992 when I joined the Lego company.
Right. And was that, so the Lego company being the Lego themselves, or was that, because for those that you may have seen on my Instagram, I used to work at Legoland, and that's how me and Guy actually know each other. So my wife worked for Guy in the Merlin Model Maker Studio. And then we got chatting. I know I was a massive Lego nerd working for Legoland, so that was great fun. And that's how kind of me and Guy met for the first time. So 92, who was that with?
92, it was via Clive Nichols, who was actually the head of PR for Lego at the time. And in the toy press, it was advertised that Lego were looking for new talent, new people. What I didn't know at that time, I thought it was to do with obviously producing kits and this kind of thing, but actually they were looking for a team in the UK to do the background design work, initial design work for what was Legoland Windsor, the second Legoland park. So, I applied, having worked in the toy industry and having known there was a potential opening, applied, and lucky enough, I actually got the job. So I was recruited with a small team to do some of the preliminary designs and also some of the landscape modelling that was done for the planning application for Legoland. So we actually built a landscape model with all of the proposed attractions on in miniature, in materials other than Lego that was submitted for planning to get the planning for Legoland Windsor.
And at the time, did you know it was going to be for Legoland Windsor, or was it just like, you're working on this project, we can't really reveal what it's going to be until we get permission to build it?
No, I must admit, we were quite lucky, A, that we were initially based out of Billund, so we knew their company plans. We were all transported back to Windsor. We did some topographical studies. We had to get the lie of the land. Obviously, the Windsor site is on a hillside. So we had to model that accurately to make sure that what they were proposing was actually going to work. And in the model that we built of the whole site, everything was sectional and removable. So at one stage, Miniland wasn't in the location within the park that it actually is now. We moved it around to fulfill various planning requirements.
Because you go to the park now and you wouldn't really imagine it anywhere else. So it's kind of, it works where it is. Where was one of the original places for the Miniland?
Initially, it was, as you look down over the site, it was further towards the left, as it were. So Miniland encroached more into where the Duplo area was. But it was decided, after all, that Miniland, as far as Lego as a company were concerned, should be the heart of the park. Therefore, it needed to be bang in the centre. So again, the sectional sections of the model were changed accordingly.
And for those that don't know a huge amount about Legoland Windsor, if you've never been or you don't live in the UK, Legoland Windsor used to be the Windsor Safari Park. So it's a very, as you mentioned, it's built on a hillside, and having to walk it every single day to get to your office is one form of exercise, I think, as an understatement. And it's you enter from what used to be the the Dolphinarium. Was that used to be at the main entrance?
It was, yes. There was cafes and shops, but also the aquariums were up the top. So we used to sit in porter cabins when we were actually designing the site and have our lunch looking over the dolphins.
Wow, that's so cool. So I didn't realise they were still there whilst the team was there designing for the park. I thought they'd all packed up, moved on, and then the Lego team?
No, when we initially started on site and doing layouts for the whole park, there were still quite a few animals in residence, and the deal was that Lego would take on the site, but not a single animal would be destroyed. So Lego rehomed every single creature from the safari park. But the interesting bit was, when we actually designed the site, you kind of think it would be straightforward. You know, it's a big area of open parkland, but actually there was lots of limitations as to where we could excavate, where we could dig, mm-hmm. and where we couldn't. Because obviously in the years gone by, the safari park had had animal losses, and some of the larger animals were buried on site. So there were designated burial sites which we couldn't excavate, which is why we had to work around those.
That's so interesting. I'm guessing, because I know they had the dolphinarium, that they had, did they have elephants in the safari park?
And rhinos, there's whale carcasses buried there as well, giraffes, some of the bigger animals, yep.
It's just crazy. Like, you go there now and you just think, yeah, it's always been Legoland Windsor, unless you visited, or like, because I used to do a business workshop for the education department. We showed a quick video. I think Terry Nutkins did a documentary, and you see it, you see the lay of the land, you kind of understand where it is, but then you look outside the window, it's like, well, there's a roller coaster there now. You wouldn't even imagine lions used to just roam freely around that area. I mean, for those that work at Legoland Windsor, we still refer to certain areas from the animals that used to live there. So you've got Cheetah Hill, you've got Badger Hill, and it's like, and some of the original, is it on Cheetah Hill? There's one of the trees is still there that the big cats used to kind of sit on.
Yeah, and also down by what's now the pirate area, that was the Egyptian land when the safari park was there, and there's various stones and carvings and that kind of thing that go all the way back to Windsor Safari Park too.
Well, I think what I love is that they've left them there, and that little bit of history is still there. And if you know about it, you can go find it for yourself as well.
Definitely. And obviously you've got things like the JFK building, you've got the Mansion House.
Yeah.
History before the Safari Park.
Yeah. So the Mansion House is, if you've been to Legoland, it's the big white building just behind the Duplo Valley. And that actually used to be, hold my office. It's a lot of the marketing team, the sales team are situated there. That's, it's the original kind of lodgings for the zookeepers, I believe.
And also the former American ambassador's residence to the UK.
Yep. So the JFK, which Guy just mentioned, is the John F. Kennedy room. So John F. Kennedy, as the president, would use that facility because it was his father was then, he was involved with the army at the time and stuff like that.
Yep, that's correct.
Yeah, it's just like, the place has so much history. I mean, you compare it to another Legoland park where you get into the entrance and you can see the end of it from the entrance. It's very flat. It's like you can see what you kind of got going on for you. With Windsor, you can't see the next land until you get into it, so it feels like a much more like an adventure.
Definitely. I mean, I think it's a slow reveal as you move through the park, mm-hmm. sort of new areas, new lands. And even when we designed the park, the idea was that you couldn't see everything. Which is why our park, the Windsor Park, has lots of park orientation rides, so train rides, the funicular, that kind of thing, so you can see different areas whilst you're experiencing a ride.
If a guest was to go now to go see the park, what would they see in Windsor now that you helped create, design? Are there any Guy Baggy Easter eggs that people can be looking for?
If I said pretty much everything, obviously with the years that I've done, I've turned my hand to a lot of things, everything from the welcome letters, the Duplo letters that you see on the driveway up the hill as you enter the park, extensive parts of Miniland on my work. But also I've got models in the castle, in Pirate Falls, in Duplo, in Fairytale Brook, Duplo Gardens, you name it, little bits. And lots of those models also have been reused in subsequent Lego parks as well.
I was going to say, I'm assuming because Windsor was the second park created, first being Billund, a lot of the models you created for Windsor would then be repurposed, rebuilt for the remaining parks that are open today.
That's it. Again, obviously, when we originally started, we started building physical Lego models in 1992. Mm-hmm. And there was a team based in central Windsor in the studio, a team of about 16 model makers there, and about 5 animators who would make some of the models come to life and move. There was a similar number of modelers in Billund, also making models for Windsor. And between the two model shops, we produced all of the models for the parks. But again, we weren't using any kind of CAD. So models were kept, or drawings and prototypes were kept, and then reused for subsequent parks. So some of the models that you see in Legoland Windsor, you'll also see in Legoland in California. They may be a different colour, but the designs are very, very similar.
I mean, obviously, Lego, Legoland, Merlin, which some people might not know who Merlin are, it's got a very colourful history. Can you just give a bit of a overview of who Lego is now, who Legoland is now, who Merlin are now? And obviously, in the last year, 2 years, there's been another big change for the companies. Can you just give a bit of a brief history, a bit of a tour of what's kind of gone on?
Yeah, so in the early 90s, Legoland was a subdivision of the Lego company, but wholly owned by the Lego company. And we were given direction from the senior team at Lego. And again, when you first joined the company, all employees spent 12 weeks in Billund, where you got to meet everybody from the CEO, as well as the design teams. Lego Park Design as a division were based there. So you were very much integrated into the company. And I remember being in a presentation from Keld talking about the kind of models and the model styles and what the ethos was behind the model we would build. So edutainment was a big thing. So learning through play. We also incorporated red threads throughout the park. So in certain areas of the park, models were only built in a certain style. So it was a bit like a branding for each area of the park. So again, we had to sort of comply with lots and lots and lots of ideas and Lego ethos. Obviously, as time went on, in the early thousands, so 2001-ish, I think Lego had quite a financially hard time. They'd opened up lots of new ventures and clothing and timepieces, computer games, and they struggled financially. So there was a bit of a downturn. And they looked to external partners and external funding. And that's where Merlin came in. So Merlin was around 2005. And effectively, they bought in the control of running the Legoland parks globally. But obviously, as you've alluded to, there's been some news fairly recently with the Lego company buying Merlin back and taking ownership of the Legoland parks back under their wing.
So for those who aren't aware who Merlin is now, so Merlin are the entertainment group that own companies like Alton Towers, Thorpe Park, Chessington, Sea Life as a brand, and as this guy just said, the Lego group. So it's the Kirkby family, the Kirkby group. They have just purchased Merlin themselves. So it's kind of gone full circle where Lego now own the Legoland parks again. So they're still operated by Merlin, but in terms for who owns them financially, it's now all back to Lego, which is amazing news for, especially for the Legoland parks, where you started to notice the Lego was becoming overshadowed by the rides and the attractions and getting people in. Whereas now it really feels that Lego is back on, it's back on its pedestal where it needs to be. It's about Lego again and rebuilding models, adding new content in, getting old models back. If you'd seen the documentary that Channel 5 did about Legoland, you see the team going into storage units, finding old original models, which, Guy, I'm sure you probably designed and built yourself. Yeah. And they're now out again, and they're back in the park, and you can see them. And it's fantastic because, yes, they look older, and the design is different to some other parts, so to other models. But there's that classic Lego feel about them that just makes you want to go visit and see what they used to look like.
Definitely. I think also with the emphasis being put back onto models and presentation and quality issues, which I think you're exactly right, Jamie, that there had been a downturn in the condition and the quality of an experience of a day out at Windsor underneath Merlin's control. I think Lego back at the helm has got to be a good thing, and it will only go forward. Yep.
Back to the history. So obviously, 92, you guys started building the park. 96, it then opened. Was that four years a difficult time? Was it a lot of time management? How was that experience for you?
Yeah, it was fantastic when I look back. It was a steep learning curve. There was three people in the team that had come from Billund that were experienced, and they had all of the new recruits to train. Again, in terms of time management, yes, we all had to suddenly start realizing we had to build Lego models to an approved quality and approved standard, but within predicted time scales. Each model had a weight allocation of bricks to it. So you also had to build it to a predicted weight scale or as near as possible. But also as well, they were trying to work out whether each of the model builders at the time had a particular penchant for maybe making architectural models or maybe making fantasy models and dragons and that kind of thing, or whether they were good as character designers. Mm-hmm. So it really was interesting. And we all had a crack at different kinds of models. So everybody was doing figures, was doing Miniland models, was doing animals, and also some of the signage and the art pieces too. And it was only really after Windsor that you really found your niche. So in 1996, Windsor opened. We then spent 1996 to 1999 building models for Legoland in California. And by time, they'd already worked out what, you know, where people's skills particularly lay. So I did a lot of Miniland models for Legoland California. I just loved building in architecture. I was better at architecture than I was for some of the show and events and the fantasy models.
So was it the complete original team from Windsor then just started straight on California?
Yep.
Wow, so I didn't realise that.
We moved. There was, again, the same team in Billund and the same team in Windsor. Literally, our brief just changed in terms of delivery dates and putting everything into a shipping container. So the same team just moved straight on.
Did you then build that in Windsor, or did they take you over to California and then you built it there? How did that work in terms for where your Lego was for building?
No. We used the same studio in central Windsor. We produced the models in Windsor and in Billund. We put them all into shipping containers and shipped them over to California to install. The reason for doing that is we had literally finished Windsor. So, for example, Fairytale Brook in Windsor is replicated in California.
Obviously, knowing yourself from working kind of for the same company and knowing what my wife did for you guys, I've seen the Lego storage. It's absolutely massive. It's the brick count alone is astonishing. I didn't realize when a new park would open. I knew you'd built models for the Discovery Centers and then you shipped them off, but I didn't realize you built things for the theme parks in Windsor.
Yes, well, when we started building the models for Windsor, again, we were based in a studio down in central Windsor, so everything was built there and then was transported by truck up to the Safari Park site. So we were a totally standalone facility for Lego. We would also produce things for trade fairs, exhibitions and display on the odd occasion too, but we were primarily focused on model output for all of the new Legoland parks. And then in 1999 through to 2001, it was Legoland in Germany at Dunsberg. So again, it was just a brand new location and we started all over again. So we were producing a new Legoland park roughly every 3 years.
And then do the themes change country to country, or do they kind of have a blanket, right? We need a Duplo, we need an Imagination, we need pirates. Obviously, Vikings is still at Windsor, but I'm not sure that's been included in the new parks. What was there any sort of guidelines you had for like a park in Germany compared to America? What sort of changed?
Again, primarily the briefs were the same. So there was always an area that was preschool Duplo. There was an area that was Flume Ride. Now, the Flume Ride might have a slight change in the brief, but mm-hmm. it might be seafaring, pirates, mermaids, and that kind of thing. California did do things slightly differently because at the time, AquaZone was big. So we did do some AquaZone-themed models for California, but primarily the main nuts and bolts of each Legoland park was the classic Lego themes. Obviously, as time's gone on, Gunsberg, for example, has a Ninjago ride and a Ninjago area, which we produced, which some of the other parks don't. But otherwise, it was primarily the same real kind of fundamentals in each of the sites.
I love it. It's so fascinating. It's like, I'm listening. I thought I knew what went on in that studio. Obviously, myself or my wife, from friends that we made there as well. But like before we started, I started Legoland in 2014, and obviously, you'd knocked out what, 6-7 parks by that point already.
Yeah, and we were, again, we'd work on things like the Christmas displays, trade fairs too. We would also work with some potential corporate partners. Some of the people that were coming into Legoland Parks would perhaps use Lego modelers in a PR campaign to promote that too. So we would produce models for those one-offs as well. But we were pretty much 24/7 producing models for a new Legoland park or a new Legoland attraction. But also by then, some of the existing parks were a few years old. They were having additions. So, for example, the Legoland Windsor Park didn't open with the castle and dragon ride. So after 96, we were building Legoland California, but also trying to shoehorn in models for the castle ride.
And then at what stage did Legoland Windsor get their own model team whilst you guys were there?
When the park opened in 96, there was a small number of personnel recruited to day-to-day look after the models. By then, they were all still fairly shiny and fairly new. But the model team from the studio down in central Windsor moved up onto the main Legoland site in 2001 when the Creation Centre was built and Rocket Racers Ride was open. So they moved us up there. And we had a studio, or still, there still is the studio with a glass wall, so you could see models being produced.
Yeah, so cool. And then at what stage, so 2001, at what stage did you then move to Merlin Magic Makers or the Merlin Model Maker?
Merlin took over in 2005, and Merlin came with an idea of a Lego Discovery Center, an LDC. And the idea was to take all of the features that were popular from a Legoland park and put them into a city center kind of location, a municipal site. And the first LDC opened in 2007. So Merlin Magic Making as a department was formed just before then to start looking at new attractions under the Merlin brand. So the first LDC was in Berlin in Germany.
I mean, listen, I could talk about Legoland and Merlin for ages. However, I want to know a little bit more about you. So at what point did you actually leave the Lego group, the Merlin group, to go be more of a freelance and collaborative builder with other companies?
That was about 2014. It was just becoming more and more difficult to maintain quality and standards within Merlin. They wanted more models produced quicker, cheaper, and yet they wanted the reliability, and it just wasn't really achievable. We were producing models for LDCs in Tokyo, Boston, Dallas, you name it, and we couldn't afford for staff to be constantly going back and forwards to those sites to repair animations that had failed. And I did have sort of some concerns that we were cutting back, or Merlin were cutting back on budgets, and we couldn't produce the quality that I was happy with. So Merlin and I went our separate ways in 2014. And I went to work with other Lego artists that were doing work collaboratively for Lego Company, for private clients, touring exhibitions, trade fairs, and that kind of thing. So, yeah, 2014 was a big year of change.
I'm in awe of the fact that you didn't just go, oh, actually, it's not for me. Let's just go get a normal 9-to-5 office job. You've continued that Lego passion from what you know you love. And just because one company couldn't offer, or it couldn't offer you the resources, the fact that you went on and then found people that are doing it professionally, just like yourself, but for themselves, and you continue to do that is great. In terms for like the big corporate events and roadshows, what sort of, where might have people seen your work? Like, what are some of the biggest ones?
Initially, in 2014, when I left Merlin, I went straight into Brick. So this was an exhibition that toured the UK. So we took Brick to London XL. We took it to the Birmingham NEC. It was also at Manchester. We took it up to Glasgow. We took it over to Belfast. I was very much involved in that. We took over 6 halls at the NEC. So designing and planning content for that. Mm-hmm. Also, we had touring exhibitions. I worked with some other freelance modelers and Lego artists, people such as Warren Ellsmore, and we took mobile exhibitions all around the UK as well, so various galleries, museums, that kind of thing. And we would often build bespoke pieces for each of the sites as well.
I love it. I mean, I never got to go to Brick myself, but I did get to go to the Great Western Brick Show over near Swindon. Are there any smaller scale ones that you've ever been involved with, or that you know of coming up, or you know the builders for, that you'd like to kind of talk about?
Certainly, you talked about one of them, which is the Great Western Brick Show, which is held at the Steam Museum in Swindon every year. Again, the organisation and the guys that run that are an amazing bunch. So they're constantly looking for new content, everything from battle bots, where Technic Lego robots battle one another in an arena. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like the Robot Wars. You get a whole load of mocks. You get lots of Lego Apples bringing up their models to display and to talk to the visitors and that kind of thing. But also we do lots of, or I have been involved with lots of exhibitions that have gone round to museums, say maybe specialist museums. So we did a big one last year called Awesome Bricks, which was at the Museum of Flight up in Scotland. So we did lots of aviation themed big builds, lots of displays up there. We've done exhibitions at places like Hampton Court Palace, which obviously have a historical theme. We did a big one, which you may well know, Jamie. We did a big model of Nottingham Castle just before it closed for its refit.
I do. Yes, I have seen that one. Yeah.
So we were there for a week with lots of local school children. We researched what the Nottingham Castle was like in its former heyday, and we rebuilt it in Lego in the existing castle.
And what was your first ever Lego set?
My first ever Lego set was the 1913 Cadillac. If I remember rightly, the set was something like 390. It was probably the late 70s, I think it came out. And I know that my parents bought it on a whim. And I know it was way out of my age group, but I battled it and I managed to build it.
I normally ask people, what was your first ever Lego set as a declared AFOL? However, I know you've been a Lego fan your whole life. So what was the first Lego set that you remember that you bought for yourself?
I think it was the Technic rescue truck. I think it was a kind of breakdown kind of rescue vehicle that could pick up a stranded car and winch it away. And again, I love that just for the functions. But as you rightly say, I kind of look at sets now, not as a set. I look at them really as the contents, which parts are in there and what can I use them for.
Ah, that's interesting. So I was going to say, in your collection, do you have many display pieces in your house, or is it mainly just brick content for building other models with?
It's 90% brick content purely to build with. I have one or two retail sets which I particularly like. So I have got one or two of those built and displayed. One of them is the Mustang. And just because I like the whole idea of an American muscle car.
Yeah.
And the other one I've got is the Mystery Machine from Scooby-Doo, just because it's fun.
Oh, it is fun. And it's such a little tiny set, but it's got a lovely bit of detail in it and really good minifigures as well. I've got that one. Largest model you've ever built, either on your own company or for Lego?
The largest model, I think, has probably got to be the ship that we built for DFDS. So Jubilee Seaways, and I worked with a team at Warren Ellsmore up in Scotland. Seven of us from DFDS, as a shipping and logistics company, had their 150th anniversary. And they wanted to do something with all of their employees to basically recognise the fact that the company had been trading. And also to showcase what they could do. So we worked with them and worked on a giant ship, which ended up being 12 odd meters long, 2.7 meters tall, over a million pieces, and was actually built on the back of a lorry trailer. If you Google Jubilee Seaways, you should find images of it. But the nice thing was we produced bespoke bags of parts with instructions for every single employee. And there was 7,000 DFDS employees based in over 20 countries. So each employee had to complete their little set to produce a big chunk of the model. And all of the chunks were sent back via DFDS logistics back to us in the UK. And we assembled all of those pieces that all of those employees had produced into a giant ship. That ship then was built on the back of a lorry. So it then toured every single DFDS staff facility around the globe, so all of the staff could see what it was they had a hand in building.
That's amazing. Not only for you guys to be a part of, but for, as I said, for the employees to be able to build a part of it and then see it in completion. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, the nice thing with that project is every member of staff, so no matter what status in the company, we had captains of seafaring vessels in their lunch hour producing a chunk of the ship, right way down to the guy that, you know, picked up the litter in the staff car park. Everybody had a hand in it. It was a real team effort.
Is it still together to this day, or do you know if it's taken apart somewhere?
No, very sadly, at the Scarebeck fan weekend last year, we had to take the ship apart because every 4 years, the truck trailer has to go through a major MOT.
Got it.
So the truck wasn't allowed on the public highways with the ship on board until it'd all be taken off and the truck inspected. So very sadly, we had to dismantle the ship. But all of the bricks were sold on to Athol's and are now in mocks all around the globe. And all of the money made from the bricks being passed on went to Fairy Bricks. Fairy Bricks are a great group of Athol's, and they're a really, really cool team. They go around to events and happenings, as it were. And what they do is they raise money to take Lego kits into hospitals to basically brighten the day of children on wards. So they go around globally taking Lego kits to underprivileged and sick children in hospital.
Next quick question. Favourite theme to build for the Legoland parks?
I would say probably the pirate theme, just because you can really let your imagination run wild. So when we did the refit of Windsor, for example, we did Crazy Octopus. The original brief for Windsor was two bumbling male pirates and a very smart and intelligent female pirate. So again, it was when we actually came to refit, we decided to go more down the caricature route. So we've got some really crazy pirates with big noses and silly feet and doing crazy things and monkeys getting in mischief and this kind of thing. So it's really nice. You can let your imagination go totally crazy.
My favourite model, I think he's still there, is the naked pirate, the one who all his clothes has been stolen. He's just there in his pirate hat, covering his dignity.
That's it. With the monkey running away with all his clothes.
That's the one. Yeah, I love that model. Favourite, and I know you said you weren't a particular collector of Lego themes, but apart from this, you mentioned the Mustang, you mentioned the Mystery Machine. A favourite Lego licensed theme?
Interesting. I'm guessing, I suppose, Harry Potter is a big one. I love the amount of detail that goes into those sets. I love the fact that the sets have developed, obviously, as have the storyline, the movies developed too. But to now look at what they're cramming into a retail set and how much detail and how much play factor there is in each kit, it's just amazing.
Final couple of questions. Favourite colour theme to work with?
Interesting. At the moment, I'm working on a whole load of pieces which are art-based, and I'm doing some mosaic-style artwork, a little bit like the sets that have been released recently. I've done some that are historical, so again, I've done some mosaics that feature Queen Victoria, Henry VIII, so again, sepia tones and greys look amazing and obviously give it a historical theme. But also, way back 2003, I think it was, I was involved with the Lego Creator launch over in the US, where there was, at the time, there was a retail kit, which was a light blue robot. And I always thought that was a bold move. It's kind of a mech-style robot, but I always thought light blue was a bit of a challenging colour. But actually, when you built the model, it looked pretty cool. So it was in a range of sort of light blues, medium blues, dark blue, with grey detailing. And actually, do you know what? That works.
Last question from me. Studs on show or not on show?
Both. That's not really answering the question, but both.
depending on the build.
It was a hot topic of conversation when we were building models for Legoland Parks. There are places where studs should be seen, purely to emphasise the Lego-ness of everything. But also as well, there's lots of build techniques that we would use snot, so studs not on top, to allow us to get lettering or detailing in where you had to use a copious amount of tiles and have smooth finishes. But also there were certain models. We built scale models for airport clusters in Miniland where we would build the fuselage of aircraft with studs showing. But we would build tiles on the top surface of the wings of aircraft just to show a difference in texture. So again, often when we would work on scale models for Miniland, we'd look at what materials the existing item is that we were trying to model was made from, and we would try and replicate that as close as we could.
Final question. How can people see your work? Is there any other accounts that you'd really like to talk about? Online, what are you working on next? What's your next big project?
To be honest, I'm not a big one for showing off or doing what I've been or showing off what I've been doing over the years. I only really came to Instagram about 6 months ago, and it was really due to COVID. I had a big sort out in my build room and my studio, and I found lots of memory cards with pictures on. I suddenly thought, it's about time I put these somewhere. So that's why I'm fairly new to Instagram, don't have a huge number of followers. But there's all these models, and I get constantly inspired by looking at other people's mocks. and ways of build and build techniques. And I just suddenly thought, there's all these pictures on these memory cards. I should really start, you know, putting them out there so people can take a look and maybe be inspired to create something similar themselves. So that's really why I've been doing it. So, yeah, on Instagram, at Guy Bagley, I do have a website, which doesn't really have a lot on it. So Instagram's probably the primary place to go look. Mm-hmm. In terms of what I'm working on at the moment, I'm working with a specialist vehicle builder in the UK that takes Volvo vehicles and turns them into mobile cranes or refuse trucks or recovery vehicles. And I'm working on them for a load of scale models to go into their facility so they can showcase the kind of conversions they do. So I'm building Volvo trucks.
That's certainly different to Lego Pirates for Legoland Windsor.
Definitely. Well, over the years, I've done everything from giant tubs of butter, chocolate vehicles, fantasy, lots of building headquarters. I do have an interest in architecture, so a lot of the models I do tend to be architecturally based. So I have quite a few of those on my Insta pages. But I'll build anything in Lego. If there was any Lego theme that you would like to see in the future, what is it and why?
Oh, so on the last podcast, I was really raving on about how much I love Lord of the Rings. However, I would love to see steampunk. I know they kind of crossed into it with Brickbeard from the Lego movie, and there was a Mixel series, which was a little steampunky, like with the gears and the browns and the golds. But if they went full on Lego steampunk with a storyline and cities and like vehicles and hot air balloons, that would be hot on my list of purchases. I would love that.
Nice. We did a steampunk fish submarine for the Lego house that was in display 2019 to 2020. That was fun to do.
Because you can mash things up with that. Obviously, you've got the Victorian influence, you've got the futuristic, you've got a little bit of everything. I know I've seen a lot of mock builders online that do like a lot of steampunk with Star Wars. So you've got like a gentleman Boba Fett or like a Victorian themed Darth Vader. And it just works so well. And the thing with Lego, the fact it's cartoony and it is supposed to be fantasy, it just works really well. So yeah, I'd love to see that theme. To those listeners, if they wanted to become a professional Lego master builder like you have with your career and your goals, what's the advice that you would give to them?
One advice really, Bowie, if that's your dream, stick with it. You can get there. You can do it. A lot of people kind of are in disbelief when you say, well, I this is my living. This is how I make my living. I'm a professional full-time Lego builder. They just cannot get their head around it. I've always enjoyed making things. It's always something I wanted to do. And I just kind of followed my dreams. I think if you badge a Lego company enough, I think if you document the mocks that you create, because a picture paints 1,000 words. If you can show Lego company, I guess a little bit like the ideas program, how you come up with your ideas, how you come up with the concepts, how you think it could work commercially, then I think you're halfway there. But just follow your dreams. Don't ever give up. You can get there.
Guy, thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy talking to you. Really interesting. Obviously, I've learned things which I thought I knew, but you've kind of opened my eyes to what's actually going on behind the scenes. So for those listening again, so you can find Guy at Guy Bagley on Instagram. You can find me at The Brick Educator. I show a lot of Guy's work as well. I know, Guy, you send me a lot for your... We're doing the Lego alphabet theme at the moment, the challenge, and you've sent me a lot of content for that. A lot of the models that I showcase in my learning themes as well, Guy's work is on there. Thank you everyone for listening. I hope you all have a wonderful Christmas. Guy, thank you again. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much.